By 2030, will AI rule everything? Will technology rule everything? And I am joined by two global leaders to predict the future. And yeah, before we came on here, Stephen was talking about common sense. And I think right now it's a good place to start, actually, because, you know, we have 98% of innovation projects failing, apparently, from what I hear. And We've got basically a world that is in turmoil right now. We've got digital ID happening in the UK. We've got all sorts of insane things, like basically people are being kidnapped to extort money from other people in Southeast Asia. They're in literally camps guarded, and they're not allowed out. And they basically have to make friends with probably 30 to 50 people a day. And they have to nurture these relationships, and then they actually need to extort money from people. And so, and that's not even a tiny amount of what's going on right now. So I don't know. What do you think, guys? Do you want to start, Daryl, and tell me your vision of the next 5 years?
Blimey, yeah, it's a big question to start with, isn't it? So I'm going to say fortunately, but let's see if it is fortunately or not. Let me first of all go back 15 years, because we published a book in 2009 that said 2020 to 2025, 26 is going to be a very, very turbulent time. And so it's great that that prediction came true. I think back in 2009 when we published the book, nobody was interested in it. It's like, yeah, God, come on, nobody can predict that far into the future. And there was even interest in how we did it. So here we are. It is 2025, obviously. We are in that turbulent period, and it did start in 2020. And I think when you're in these kind of turbulent periods where you listen to the media and you hear the words omni-crisis, mega-crisis all the time, crisis itself is just, it's almost like in every sentence. It's characteristic of these periods in history. So in trying to predict what's going to happen during these periods, it's extraordinarily difficult because you're almost in a situation where literally anything can happen. So I think what we can say with some clarity is that these periods do come to an end, but the crises that we're in do come to an end. It's difficult, if not impossible, to predict which one is going to be the dominant crisis. That when that one ends, it's going to end all the other ones. But I think what we do know is that events happen at random, but society's reaction to those events is very much conditioned by who we are as people. That's how we were able to predict back in 2009 what was coming. So I think there's already a very strong desire. I mean, you've just given some beautiful examples there of how society and people in society are just looking at all this craziness around them and are saying to themselves, when is this going to end? So I think there's a great will for some calm to appear. So when we get this kind of stabilizing event, then I think things will calm down quite quickly. However, we've just put together a book, which hopefully is going to come out by the end of the year, which is all about ethical contradictions. I think that's got a big part to play in the future prediction. But it ends by saying, look, 2020, we started this age of what I call the unmooring. So all those things that we as individuals grab onto to say in our lives, I understand this. Yeah, this is working for me. All of those moorings are just disappearing. Now, largely, I think, and for most people, prompted by AI, is it going to turn my job into nothing, etc.? It's literally an existential crisis. So we've got this unmooring. And then I think starting this year, next year, and then in some pockets you could say it's kind of already started, is what I call an age of unveiling. And that's a realization that a lot of those things that we took for granted in life are just aren't true, and things that made us successful in life no longer will make us successful. So we've got to take these veils off, if you like, and just see reality and see particularly how AI is changing that reality. And I think that's going to give us a period of adjustment, we being society. While that's going on, I think that one of the things we can see with the AI companies is that because it can do massive amounts of calculations and, you know, therefore enormous optimization very, very quickly indeed, then the money in society very quickly migrates towards those people with the power. So, you know, you've got the Amazons, the Googles, the Microsofts, the Metas of the world that are just like money vacuums. Money just attracts to them. And I think that's bringing to us a world of, I've been calling it tech feudalism. So, yeah, those people are so powerful and have so much control over the politicians as intermediaries, but as humans then as users, because we all become users in that tech feudalism. And I think we're going to go through a period of that. And I'm hoping that that period of tech feudalism is not going to endure for very long, but I think it will be with us in 2030. If that's our horizon for today, I think we'll be, you know, by 2030, I think it will be a world dominated by tech giants with the power that AI has given them.
Yeah. That sounds about right. So what do you sort of think, Steve, on this? Do you think there's, it's kind of crazy, isn't it, right now?
As much as I would like to, I can't challenge my friend Daryl. there's nothing that I can challenge. A couple of thoughts that I went through my mind as you were so eloquently speaking. Just to start with, I called Nostradamus early this morning and asked him what he thought about this. And he said, hey, bud, you're on your own. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm not on my own. I get to talk to these two later. So the thing that fascinates me, among other things, is the vertiginous rate of change. It's dizzying. And the dissonance between the rate of change and our collective, most of our collective ability to absorb it. And I will digress in a moment, but that makes us, in my opinion, mostly thoughtless users rather than thoughtful users. Technology is always ahead of social and political constructs, and by and large, economic constructs. As you say, if Elon Musk decides that this is a good thing to do, there's a time, the means, the ability, and just the pure brute force of self to push that narrative. And as you say, the feudalism of it, the tech giants and so on, the rate of change is fascinating to me. If I may, maybe 10 years ago, I forget, I was asked to go talk to the Chicago Business Council. And the topic was, what is marketing going to look like in the next 20 years? My response was, thank you. I don't belong in front of that Lacoste group, you know, because no matter my education, I'm the least educated and accomplished person in the room. You know, there's only so many real estate billionaires in one room. And everybody in that room has at least a master's, if not a PhD from Ivy. And I'm just an immigrant boy from a small town in Romania. So I said, no. Okay. So I said, how that? I don't know what I'm going to have for lunch, much less what's going to happen in 20 years. I'm not a soothsayer. So I thought to do the right thing. And I made a list of 20 or 25 people that I thought were relevant. You know, a couple I knew, most of them just relevant. They're writing, speaking, a couple of really massively published people, university folks, et cetera. A couple of people who led massive companies. I warm my way in, ask a simple question. Tell me five things that are going to happen next 20 years that are going to shape marketing. Well, after they all stop going laughing and asking me if I sustained some double brain damage, they started coming up, well, I think this might happen, that might happen. I made a list, a long list. And I looked at it and I said, and that guy has 47,000 employees. Oh, God save us. That guy's a neurosurgeon. That guy is tenured two places. I said, oh, okay. So I looked at it. So I literally reduced that down to 15 things that were on the spectrum of mental disorder. It's like, are you kidding? So I prefaced my little talk by saying off the top of my head that I have no clue what's going to happen next year. I run a little business. It was so little. By then, it was bucking along, I don't know, maybe $750 million a year. But we're an ordinary marketing company. But here's what the bright people think. And you have these people looking like, the reason I relate that story is because 10 years later, all that stuff was already obsolete.
Yeah.
It was Gene Roddenberry. It was Rod Sperling. It was Phantasmagoria. And a couple of years later, it was real. How the hell do we absorb that? Well, we don't. We are either roadkill on the technology superhighway, or we jump on that wagon. The problem I have with that is there's too many smart people just ride that. I keep saying you have three choices in life. You can lead, you can follow, get out. What's the point of getting out? I mean, that's what, you know, capitulate? You can follow. Good. I can't wait to be in a company with a lot of followers. All right. It's mush. It's brain mush. And then occasionally you find a real leader. The problem is that level of change, that level of change that's driven so much by technology and with a bump and grind with society all the time, butting heads. Most people end up on the wagon just following, because what choice do you really have? And, you know, I'm contemplating some 1985, I think it was. I was driving a formula race. Don't ask. When it was done, I had the most absurd adrenaline rush in my life. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't talk. I was soaked to the bone. I got in my nice car, and I was going to drive back to the hotel and call one of my friends saying, what do I do? Because I'm shaking. I went to the first hamburger joint, bought two hamburgers, a gallon of orange juice, air station out of San Francisco. Two scientists were talking about something they just don't. They patented the breast milk of a pregnant woman they did not know. Now, evidently, there was something in her breast milk that was akin to interferon, something like that. And some doctor published that, said, imagine that you can only produce in a pure vacuum in space, but Mary Ellen is producing it in Los Gatos, California. And this is where the train jumps the tracks. They applied for a patent, U.S. Patent Office, for that. And it was granted. I applied for a patent for something no one's ever heard of before, and they harassed me for 2 years. But my very point is that, isn't that astounding in context of development? And again, I think that we are at an amazing crossroads because the speed of change is very hard for people to digest, so they basically accept. Now, when you accept the cataclysmic change in your life, cataclysmic is a huge word, but you accept that. Ultimately, it's the same idea as when, on a personal or business basis, you lay an ultimatum on someone, accept this or else. And when you do that, two things will happen, 100% certainly. One, The person will acquiesce, give in, accept. But the only problem with that is that to 100% certainty, they will find the opportunity to sabotage the matter in time. Because they've been humiliated, put in a corner, they know they belong, but they don't want to. Or they just fight out. Then you have bloodshed, you know, physical, literal or not. So the rate of change is what fascinates me. Everything that I know today, and you've actually highlighted that for me in a couple of different ways last time we talked. Everything I know today, and I get to take that cleansing breath because I adopted, I accepted. Okay, cool. This is cool. I got it. Hell, 10 minutes from now, Elon Musk tells me I'm obsolete. All I have to do is go to Rock. And I'm obsolete.
But that's the point.
Anyway,
it's
a long way to add a little bit to what you said. And again, Nostradamus is still hysterical, that I call him.
Yeah, I mean the world's got a horrendous record of failing to predict the future. I think the Philip Tetlock put the book out a few years ago, Super Forecasters. So he did this kind of empirical study of who's good at predicting the future and what did they do. And the UK government, or the previous UK government, was kind of enamored by it and started advertising for these super forecasters. But basically, it was people who were skeptical and challenged things. And there wasn't an awful lot of science to it. And I was watching this going on when it looked like the UK government was going to go down this direction, filled with horror, because they'd all missed the key insight, which is that you can't just predict the future by extrapolating what's currently happening and say, oh, we're going to get more of that. It just doesn't work that way. Fortunately, when people are challenging things, then there's a chance that they'll identify some of these conflicts and contradictions that prevent things coming to fruition that they might have predicted. So a book that came out after that was the Margaret Heffernan book, Uncharted, I think it was. But it basically said, if you look at who the best people in the world at seeing what's coming, the horizon seems to be about 400 days. Yeah, beyond that, everything just goes wildly wrong. I can certainly see a lot of evidence of that, 400 days. And I think, to your point, Steve, I think it's shrinking and it's shrinking and it's shrinking. I mean, you mentioned marketing, and we did a little exercise a few months ago now, really as a contrast to some work that came out of Oxford University a few years ago, when we could see the AI wave was coming. And this Oxford study predicted all the jobs that will be gone. Complete nonsense, because, again, they fell into the trap. So one of the things that was on their list, for example, was taxi drivers gone. And it's like, you haven't really understood autonomous cars and the lack of maturity of those things. Yeah, that's not going to happen. One of the things that wasn't on the list was marketing. Because AI can't do creative work and marketing people do creative work. But I don't know if you've seen that, if you've got a version of the advert in your countries right now, but probably been on the UK television for about a month now, which is there's a couple of women, they're in a retail store, they're looking at facial care products, just facing a wall of products that they say to themselves and to each other, I've got no idea what I want here. So woman one gets out her phone, fires up a Samsung AI, personalized AI, points the camera at the shelf and says, what do you think? Yeah, and the AI comes back and says, shows her a photo and says, yeah, that's the one that suits your skin type and suits your ethics, etc. And as soon as I saw the advert for the first time, you think, okay, it is game over for marketing now, because what's already happening, I think that that's just the first public version of it, is it's not selling to a person anymore, it's selling to the AI. It's AI selling to AI.
But it's not the end of marketing. Marketing is just going to adapt to that, because then people have to learn how to basically create a better brand, right? And learn how to actually sell their products to the search, but also they've actually just brought in the payment engine. So you can actually buy things through ChatGPT now, apparently, or very close to that.
Yeah.
And Google patented something, didn't they, on that front? So you're going to be able to order stuff directly through your browser without even ever touching a website, which is going to be interesting.
It is AI to AI. But sorry, I mean, totally take your point. You know, Nat, that if I'm a marketing person, I hear that message and I see that ad on television.
Well, you panic.
My first thought is panic. My second thought is, okay, what am I going to do about this? And I think very quickly what has to happen is, so you say, okay, I'm a creative person, I can see a problem, then I'm going to work my way around that problem. And I think probably the best solution that you'd come up with is say, okay, I better go and work for GPT then. Yeah, and help design the algorithm that's going to make sure that when your AI talks to the manufacturer's AI, then the right connection is made. In other words, that the consumer's AI buys from my AI.
Yeah, but it's something to say. I think that
if I may, on marketing creativity, I've been around that for a bit. You learn a thing or two doing that for years, and many billions in commerce, and many, many multiple million sellers. I think that what we're looking at today, and this gives me hope, is that AI has introduced two things simultaneously. One, incredible efficiency, without a doubt, and a degradation to creativity and uniqueness. It's astounding when you go and type in, I want the unique perspective of selling that particular nail polish or that Honda. And then the big old machine goes crank, crank, chews up a whole lot of natural resources and tells me a unique perspective. And then I turn around, and I used to do this all the time. I would walk out of my office, walk through, bullpen, I said, everybody's attention, please. Ladies only. Three things. One, two, three. What do you think? And I had myself a lovely survey of 30 people, unfair in as much as I knew them. And they, to some extent, were biased because I was asking the question. They knew I was looking for the part where somebody's going to say, what? If I may digress, a simple example. I branded a collectibles company. They were big enough when we started, but they didn't have an online presence. I created the online presence. And the first product I sold was a $150 doll. Lifelike doll, baby doll. Was the ugliest thing ever manufactured in the history of the world. How ugly was Emily? I had Emily on a chair in my big office in the corner. And every time I got hungry, I would look at Emily, lose my appetite. Now, I thought that was the second coming of marketing, but they had no presence. They had a ton of money, a mature company. Now, this goes back 20 years, more than 20 years. By then, they were doing about $200 million in direct response, zero online. I mean, 20 years ago, that's when men first began walking upright. So I created the online thing, and they said, we have to sell Emily. I said, I'm going to be laughed at for two reasons. No one sells anything online for $150. It's all free. And when I go to my constituents or media owners, I'm going to say, you want to do what? I'm going to sell that for $150 online? Lost your mind. So I went ahead and spread some money around to compel people to prove my client wrong. Well, for 2 years, we had the first time ever controlled circulation on the internet because everyone wanted to do it. The payout was huge. And for some reason, I said, there must be a lot of people out there who can't have kids. They're going to buy this. And that's what they think their kid's going to look like. How sad. Now, the reason I tell you this is that we put out, that's at the beginning of this madness called the internet. 3, 4, 5 billion emails a year. 10 years later, we're putting out 2, 3 billion a week. And then for another client, we're putting out 1, 2, 3, 4 billion a day. But back in the day. So one of the things I had to do is write these glorious subject lines. So people read the darn email because the open rates were nothing. My margin was huge, which made it better open rates. And I would send my client a list of 40 or 50 at the time. Have legal look at them because they were blue chip. And legal will sign off on this, that, the other. And one day I wrote a subject line that said, Daryl, baby Emily was born healthy and happy, 7 pounds, 9 ounces, 19.5 inches. Now, my client approved it. I called, we're going to get handcuffed. I'm kidding. The open rate was 100 times higher than, I mean, it's astounding. Hmm. Everybody opened the darn email. The women, because they said, who's having this baby now? My husband? The men said, I don't, where was I 9 months ago? Everyone opened the email. I would like an AI bot to write that. No, I'm not patting myself on the shoulder because I thought it was funny. The client actually went and tested it, wrote back, unbelievable. We're going to run out. How can you run out? Hmm. We're going to sell two. No, we're not. So the problem I'm having, not a problem, but the opportunity remains for people like you to be more creative than the sterility environment creates by definition.
Yeah, yeah. Let's be clear. What if I'm the marketing person, my biggest asset is my creativity. And when I look at AI, the glorious thing I see is it can't do creativity. So big thumbs up, I've got a secure future. But my hypothesis about my AI is going to buy from your AI and cut the middleman out is that creativity is not going to be spent on advertising anymore. Because that email, because I do receive a trillion emails in my inbox, I ain't going to go through them. Yeah, my AI is going to go through them. And my AI is not interested in what happened 9 months ago, Daryl. Yeah, my AI is going to say spam, 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 spam. And so all that creativity in that situation has just been filtered out by the AI. So I think that the marketing person, let's think of that person as being world's most creative person, has got a bright future ahead of them. But I don't think it's right in advertising slogans.
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, yeah. I don't want to get trite. There's 9 ways to skin a cat. I believe, and I've done enough writing lectures on this about the role or opportunity for creativity in every aspect of life and business.
Yeah.
Every aspect. People look, I'm not creative. I don't really. The kid that got his first job as a filing clerk, how do I put that on the resume? Well, there's a couple ways to put that on a resume. Again, I'm a filing clerk, minimum wage, or I mean document management. And retention.
Yeah.
But, okay, now the AI is going to pick those words out. It's document retention and management. File clerk. Now, of course, there's a whole science associated these days with writing a resume and pitching a job. Because if I don't have my AI bot the way I think it should work, prepare that for that AI bot, I'm not going to get to an interview. That's the reality. You know, I don't think creativity is dead. I think it's challenged. And yes, we need to rethink that.
I think it's where it gets focused.
Every aspect of what you do. Are you now?
Yeah, absolutely. The future is the creative person.
I've got to tell you, you can fill the bottle this way, you can fill the bottle that way. For millennia, people are filling the bottles this way. Daryl says, and why? We can fill it that way. Oh, good. Massive problem solved.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. You know what? That's off the reservation thinking. It is.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And that's where the future is. Yeah. So I'm saying those people are the creatives. they're the people that can do stuff that the AI can't do. But it's, but you know, part of that creativity now, I think, becomes where do I get to play that game where it's about breaking the rules and I need to go beyond the AI? Because on the resume front, I'm working with a client at the moment. Yeah, they get 1,000 applicants typically for each job. Nobody's going to read through those resumes that come in. So guess what? The AI reads through it. And guess what? Also, the AI has been trained to recognize, oh, yeah, that resume was written with GPT, out. Yeah, that one was written with Claude, out. Yeah, right. And so...
Yeah, but then you can... If you're smart, right, then you do a combination of the two. You know, I mean... It's not just going to throw it out just because there are a few words that are everywhere.
It is doing.
I mean,
it is doing.
It is.
It is doing. Yeah.
Wow.
It is doing. Yeah.
So basically, the AI is becoming biased towards people that use AI.
It's. I mean, it's recognized that the algorithm's been written by the company. So the company says, "Look, my values are authenticity, for example. So anybody that's written a GPT resume to me is lazy. They can't be bothered yet thinking about this company. They're not the sort of person we want." And so, in their minds, writing an algorithm that says filter out GPT applications, I would say is quite a smart move. If those are the values of my company, then I've got 1,000 resumes to go through. I need to find some way of filtering out because I'm only going to read 3 or 4. If GPT is a sign of somebody who's lazy, then bye bye.
Well, wow. There's an interesting aspect just sharing a person I mentor because it's in a PhD program in education. We survived the master's degree. Thank you. I never got a certificate. I never got a certificate at a fine university, but we survived it. The last test we took was awful. I actually spent 2 days studying to help take that test. But the amount of reading this person is doing is overwhelming. And so much of it is learning and then the presentation part. And I got to read some of the writing. And bright person, sophisticated, has a future. And I read it and I say, I'm having intellectual whiplash. You are doing something that I get criticized for doing. Specifically, I'm not a native English speaker. I learned this language in my late teens. And the way I learned the language is by learning a lot of words. In time, I began to put them together because I sounded like a badly written Chinese menu. And the whole conjunction preposition stuff, that's for lesser people. So that makes people like me, and I'm not unique, rather verbose. It's kind of like, okay, I can say it in 10 words. Maybe I'll try it in 15. And big ones. It was painful to learn them.
Yeah.
And I read this and say, hey, this is cool if I understand it, prefacing I may not. And then she gives me a damn bibliography. I don't have time to read the 4 books. But AI can tell me what the highlights of the 4 books are. That's cool. I don't have to read it. Why is this so complex? Why is this so wordy? It's overbroad. And she tells me that absolutely she must do that because she cannot afford the hint. The minor smell of AI written stuff because it's rejected automatically by her professors, and there's an environment that they use. And I said, explain. So let me show you this paragraph. I'm reading this paragraph that's 7,000 words, of which I understand none, but, I said, so, okay. And the annotations and the quotes and all that. I said, cool. It was rejected. Why? There's a quote in here, a quote from a book written by a Maslow type guy. And the reason that was rejected is because that particular quote from that particular book, it, they, him, who, whatever, deemed to have been AI written. So I'm quoting you from a book, and my thesis is rejected because there are six words there that the thing says ChatGPT. Now, the amount of work this person has to do to create what would be otherwise, well, not ordinary, because after all, it's a PhD program, to do that is phenomenal. Now, is that qualitatively better? No, it's bloody burdensome is what it is. Okay, you can summarize that in 50 words, not 400. So, you know, I only say that in context of one of the things I love to say, which is, you know, sometimes an abacus or slide rule is better than that 1.74 petaflops computer. It just is.
Yeah.
We get there. Now, the 1.74 petaflops thing is really greased lightning. It's really fast. But you know what? I don't have time to fire up my laptop when this thing is jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. I got to stop her doing that. And this is what I think I'm going to do. I'm not going to research what to do. I'll just do it. That's a bit of a ordinary comparison, if you will, or example, if you will, that it's a fascinating thing. You know, it's and a big topic. We're all going to lose our jobs. AI. It's over. I said, no, I don't think so. Some will. Some industry segments specifically might. But then, okay. I'm not as smart as the behemoths that you referenced before, the feudal lords that drive technology. But I'm going to sleep just fine because I heard Doug McMillian. He's the CEO of Walmart. Walmart is the biggest employer we've got, 2.1 million people, who stated emphatically that for the next 3 years, these workforce will not be reduced. Now, accounting, by the way, accounting for or adjusting for seasonality, all that, no. As an absolute, the workforce will not be reduced. Although, and to point to the Holy Grail, he made deal with the aforementioned Mr. Altman, and they are now have a whole bunch of training seminars for all many employees that want to, some that need to show the way to use AI in the job.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. He says, I got 2.1 million people today. I have 2.1 million, same 2.1 million 3 years off. Not different, the same. But we will train many of them to use the great new mechanism here.
I think that's a smart move. I think it's, I mean, what I would say in that situation is that some industries are more immune to the incoming of AI than others. So, for example, so Walmart, a beautiful example. Any organization that's in the food industry, people need food. I mean, the usual saying is we're three square meals away from revolution. So society breaks down if we don't get food. So if you're in the food industry as a leadership team, you say, I'm going to protect those 2 million people that work for me, then there's not an awful lot of work, not a lot that the outside world can do to challenge that because people are still going to buy food from you. I can see that works really well for the next 3 years. If one of the other supermarket companies says, okay, well, I'm going to be a bit more ambitious than that, and I'm going to say, all the people that work for me, there's an emotional intelligence part to the job and there's an IQ part to their job. And I'm going to work out what that ratio is because the IQ part, the AI can do that way better than the human being can do. Yeah. So I'm going to keep all those people with the emotional intelligence skills and train them, to your point, Steve, how to get the best out of the AI so that the AI can do all the IQ jobs. I'm going to do that fairly quickly. So, let's say of those 2 million people, half of them are customer facing. They're people in the store. So there's a fairly high EQ component to what they do. But the other half, it's IQ work. Yeah, it's spreadsheets. And the AI can do that way better. So I'm going to target those, that 50% of my working population that's emotionally intelligent, and I need them for that emotional intelligence. I'm going to equip them with the skills to be able to ask the AI the right question, yeah, such that it can do the IQ jobs. And when that training process is paying dividends, then I can start removing people from my organization quite quickly now. So the IQ, the IQ jobs will be replaced by AI. But
there are a lot of IQ jobs today. A lot of IQ jobs. I mean,
you make
an excellent point. You know, right now, certainly here, any radiologist that does not use AI is a fool, because AI can see what the radiologist cannot, the naked eye cannot. The analytics fail. The AI thing is just better. So, how does she protect his income stream? That's a very interesting idea. How do you do that? Theoretically, he can do a lot more work more efficiently. The only problem with that is the insurance company structure that we have here that is designed to allow you to die rather than allowing you for the procedure. That's a problem we have here. Now, it's also, now, I am so pleased that the board of Tesla has decided to give in to Elon Musk. And they're going to give him $1 trillion in 3 years, speaking of 400 days, in 3 years, if he hits certain benchmarks. Now, Elon, who, by the way, yesterday at 3 o'clock, surpassed the $500 billion net worth yesterday at 3 o'clock.
Yeah, but he's trying to keep up with the owner of Oracle, right?
I don't know how to say this, but Larry Ellison is probably contemplating suicide because he was the richest man until the market went up 2 points on Tesla, and now Elon is $150 billion more. But anyway, my point being is that his point was there's no way I want to be part of the enterprise unless I can lead it. And he said, if I'm going to manufacture millions of robots, I want to make sure that the quality is what it's supposed to be. And I can't do that unless I run the enterprise. Tesla board said, yes, sir. Now, by the way, I did read the book you referenced and about the four. I think she is a very optimistic person when she talks about foresight of 400 days. I am limited. I'm struggling with tomorrow. I'm struggling with things I must do tomorrow. I'm clear on what I must do because that's the way I am. And I will do because that's the way I am. I'm a little confused about, say, December. Mm. And I don't want to be roadkill on your world. And I think the thing that saves the day, and I'm not trying to be nice to you. I like you a lot, but not that much. The thing that saves the day is people whose focus is uniquely to take advantage and take that next step. And, you know, we live in most of us, 99.9% of us live in a Baconian world, very Baconesque. There, everything for us is deductive. If this is true, what next? Mm-hmm. And what's next and next? I think that elevates certain people, plateaus above the rest of the world, who look at the thing that the thing speaks for itself until I think I can do better. Or wait a minute, the thing does not speak entirely for the matter. It speaks for itself. Now, I don't know if I'm being obtuse here, but you look at what's happening and you accept it and you improve it. Anybody smart can improve on somebody else's brilliance by 1 or 2 points. Not the point. That's not why you get hired. And the people who hire you have a tremendous amount of capital, human, intellectual, financial, so on. You don't get hired by a whole lot of small, struggling enterprises. And yet it is expected, and I expect it, that you will look at the thing and say, it's this is what it is, but why should it be? And you don't look at it. You know what? I can improve that by 1 or 2%. Congratulations. Anybody, if I know everything you know about the darn thing, I can improve it by 2%. I don't have to a whole lot of competency, but this is what it is, but it should not be. Question is, why is it? And again, going back to, forgive me, Manningism, to newborn, every joke is new. To me, that, okay, we've done it this way for 34 years. We're doing $40 billion a year in business. How are you going to make that better? Yeah, I don't know. To newborn, every joke is new. Just because you've always done it this way, what does that mean to me? Not much. I can learn from the failure rate there, not the success.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? We've got a very interesting moment in time, actually, at the moment, because I was reading a post on LinkedIn the other day that really made me think. And what the guy said was, he said it's possible to actually launch a business now with AI within the space of maybe 2 weeks, right? And actually, you can launch that business so quickly, you can monetize it, and then you can sell it. So what he said was, there's going to be a whole load of companies that just specialize in building and selling those businesses. And I just thought that was quite sharp. But then I actually spoke to a guy today, right? I spoke to a guy today who's developing a technology, okay? And I'm not going to talk about what it is, but it's an interesting technology. And I said, so when did you start this? He said, July. And I was like, huh? I literally couldn't believe it, because he's actually going to launch in January, right? Like, it's and that is slow. Like, that's actually slow. But the number of features that I put in there, I was quite impressed, to be honest.
You know, I challenge that for two reasons. One, there are a million new businesses started in the United States every year. Yeah. How many fail? What do you think the percentage of failure rate is? 90%? Over 90% fail within 1 year, or certainly, mm-hmm. Why? A couple different reasons. First of all, the people who start them are underfunded, which is almost always the case. Two, they don't have a competency to run a business. And then the idea was folly, silly. But, you know, the starting the thing in a heartbeat, two ways to do it. I did a thing. I was one of 8 speakers at a conference on starting a business in a developing market. Now, in other words, what do you do when you want to start selling the blah, blah in Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa? And I was a designated victim, because I was the only one that ever spent his own money starting a business in a third world country, if you will, or a developing countries. Everybody else worked on major insurance, major manufacturing, and so on. You know, there it's really cool. You get a budget of $30 million, staff of 10, you move into the big city, and you do a study of 2 years. And you come back with a book. This is how. So how did I do this? Well, my mom called me and asked me to help out this family. And 6 months later, we were at a business in 8 countries. Now, I think that the difference, in deference to the guy who writes that, some businesses, I have been thinking about this, working on it for 7 years. I finally know enough. I think I'm prepared. I have the wherewithal to do it. The other thing is, you'll forgive the immodesty, is spending the night on an overnight flight from Los Angeles to Santiago, Chile, sitting next to Jack, whose dad turned, whose father-in-law, Jenny's dad, whom I happen to know Jenny. Jenny writes a gossip column for 20 magazines in South America. Turns out he owned the biggest horse ranch in Chile. And the business was born 2 hours after we landed. The man had a big problem. All that horse manure, there's only so much you could sell in South America. The rest of barges being towed out of the Pacific, dumped in the water. So I said, tell you what, for a little bit of money, I'll take that off your hands. The Messiah. That business was born on that flight, and it was operating within weeks. What did we do? I just took tons and tons of that, put in container ships, and sent them off to Rottenburg. I sent it to Germany. Why? The Germans coincidentally outlawed synthetic fertilizer, and they were running short of steer manure. I said, what's the difference between steer manure and horse manure? Not much. Okay, so that's how he became the horse manure king of South America in a heartbeat. Now, that business was born on a flight because Jack told me about the farm. I was reading about the German stuff. We didn't go anywhere from the airport but to see his father-in-law. And he was so happy. Somebody's going to take all that horse manure off my hands. I said, you know, some businesses are born that way.
Yeah, I think the element of good fortune is usually dismissed in any kind of entrepreneurial book, whereas I think it's an absolutely crucial part. And I think you just given us a beautiful story of that kind of happenstance. I think what AI increasingly does, though, I mean, back to that your start point for this bit of the discussion, is that it makes that kind of happenstance much more achievable now. Because I think I can say to my AI, look, these are my skills. Go and find for me customer frustrations out there that are consistent with those skills. Because there's a great start point to making those magical connections with somebody with a problem and somebody with the skills to solve those problems. And I think that's trying to say actually is that the great skill of using AI is knowing what questions to ask. So if I'm an entrepreneur, wow. That I can set up a business an awful lot more quickly now. Yeah, I can find the opportunity. I can have my idea. I can get the AI to write the patent, submit the patent for the idea, so I've got protection. Yeah, who's the best manufacturer for this AI? AIs can look at the drawings and say, okay, yeah, you need a person in China. And an awful lot of that stuff that I would have spent hundreds of thousands of miles on planes thinking about and talking to people, I can cut out an awful lot of the noise now by asking the right question of the AI.
Well, you know, it's actually very primal. You remember when we were children and we're talking about all this technology, computer stuff, and people, smart people, as you know, garbage in, garbage out when it comes to analyzing data. Well, right, that's where we are. I mean, it's very primal. Ask a garbage question, you get a phenomenal garbage answers.
Yeah.
Or great answers to a lousy question.
True.
I think the art form is asking the really, really seminal question, the bottom line question.
Yeah.
You can go layers and layers above and beyond that. I would love one day for AI to come back to me and say, hey, Steve, what exactly do you mean? Do you know what you're asking? That'd be kind of cool.
If you tell the AI that you want it to challenge you, it will do. It will already do that.
I will be schooled on that right after we're done here.
But it's amazing. So do you think then that the failure rate of businesses is going to be more or less because of this wave of AI.
I love the question. I think it's one of those ones which is unanswerable, honestly, because what I just described suggests that it would get better. Because for a start, I would find things which are consistent with my skills, to Steve's point. For a start, I would find, if I ask the right question, what are the customer frustrations out there? That's a good question to go and ask. So I would get rid of a bunch of those other early failures, which is, you create something that the market sees no need for. So I think on the one hand, we eliminate an awful lot of the failure modes that are there at the moment. I think the other side of that coin, because there is always the other side of the coin, is now we open up a whole bunch of new failure modes. Part of that is that has somebody else had the same idea?
True. When you're in the morning in this great country of ours, yours, and you're standing in front of that mirror brushing your teeth, and you have that eureka moment, You have the idea. You know it's the Idris Know. Whatever, you know. And you say, this is something we must do. You can be certain there's 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, 100,000 other people standing in front of the mirror, shaving, brushing teeth, having the same thing. You can also be certain of two things. You're going to go to your desk, your office. This is it. But you find stuff there, and there's stuff coming at you that's in the course of what you're already doing, and you have to fix it. Yeah, I will get back to that. I have to get back to that. There are 1, 2, 3, 9, 27, 35, 157 people who go to the office and say they have the means, they have the just a pure brute willingness, conviction, whatever, and they have the funds to actually do that. And when you come back to 3 months later, you hear about some Silicon Valley whiz bang kids funding that $2 million for the dude to continue. Meanwhile, the whole family chipped in $1,000 to get him started. And you say, why? That was my idea. No, it's yours too. So you're right. Yeah. Somebody else is doing that already. One of the questions I get to ask of people who come with the most amazing ideas. And the point is that I will ask, this is very cool. You are aware that you're behind, I don't know, countless people. That industry is producing $28 billion a year in the United States today. Uh-oh. I said, okay, whoa. Well, and then you have a deflated person, my God. No. Let's back up. And I said, you know, I really like Avis better than Hertz.
Why?
Because it's a brilliant Me Too business. Okay, so Avis says back to us, what's Hertz doing that we like, don't like? Let's not do that. That turned out to be poor. I'm cool with the Me Too business. As long as your next step, Bob, Mary Ellen, is to figure out how to attain a unique advantage in the marketplace. Doing what? Making chocolate chip ice cream like everyone else does. What can you create as a unique advantage in the marketplace? That moves the paradigm from the product to the golden goose. One, find the audience, figure out how to appeal to them. And that's what you sell into. You know, it's a fascinating thing where mature companies don't do that. They're in a silo. This is what we do. And we become really, really, really vertical. We just do more and more and more and more. And then we look at longing with everyone else is doing some other stuff. You know, the question is, well, maybe we should do that too. Well, you know, all the biggest have found out that diversification has two sides, really good one and a really bad one. You know, and most of them come down to the bad part. You know, let's divest ourselves of all the shiny pennies we bought, brain drain at the highest levels, you know. But yeah, you know, a wonderful human being that ran General Motors explained to me that we don't know anything about running a laundry chain in Florida, so we sold it. We make cars. No, we don't make cars. He educated me. We don't make cars. What do you mean? General Motors does make cars. No. We're in the finance and the real estate business, Steve. We also happen to make cars. I've been thinking about that for a couple of decades now.
Yeah, but that's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah. So Daryl, I've got a question actually.
Yeah, I do.
So onto innovation, onto systematic innovation. What's the biggest mistake that you see C-suite leaders making with systematic innovation as they implement AI? Because I know they're all saying they want AI, and yet they don't quite know what they really need and what they want.
For the most part, they don't. No, I mean, I think there's a huge irony in this whole situation, I think, when it comes to leadership right now, because I think enormous pressure on the leaders, because no doubt your shareholders, your bosses are saying to you, you need to be doing something with AI. So you've now got to, at the very least, go back with a response that justifies why you're not going to do that or what you are doing. The irony then is that introducing AI into your organization in whatever form is an innovation. You know, it's forcing you to do something different to what you were doing before. And that opens up the bright new problem, which is that very few, if any, of those leaders understand what innovation is. Because mm-hmm. what made them successful in their career is being efficient, hitting KPIs, and not getting stuff wrong. And almost by definition, even though we call it systematic innovation, you know, there are going to be times when things go wrong. And that's called learning in innovation world, but CEOs don't understand that for the most part. So I think the naive expectation, I will call it that, from leaders who are brought up into a vertical world, they've been very successful at running an efficient business, and suddenly they've got to think about disrupting that business. So whether it's AI or any other change inside the business, things are going to get worse for a while. And I think that's where the look of horror starts to appear on faces, because I'm not going to go back to my shareholders and say that things are going to get worse for a while, because that's not a pleasant message. So, Daryl, can you give us a solution whereby things will get better? So I want to do bright, exciting new things with no risk and no possibility that things will get worse. To which my answer usually is, well, if you'd have started 3 years ago, then we could have done that. But unfortunately, you've left it too late. So I think one of the things that systematic innovation will do for you, and you know, we've used it many times with clients, is to say, from where you are right now, there are no opportunities, because we know all the roadmaps that will work. Yeah, you can go down this direction or this direction or this direction. With the resources you've got, you know, where you are right now, none of those will work. There are no more roadmaps. Yeah, we keep looking for them. There are no more roadmaps. Right. You're going to have to accept now that something is going to get worse. So what's the mm-hmm. thing that you're most happy getting worse? Is it EBITDA? Is it return on investment, market share? Tell me what you're willing to accept is going to get worse, and then we can see if there's an opportunity opens up as a result of that. But it's all about S-curves and how mature the organization is. And pretty well guaranteed, by the time the CEO gets involved in things don't seem to be going as well as they were, this law of diminishing returns, they're already at the top of the S-curve. Once you're in that position, the only way is down. You're going to go down while you find the new S-curve. I think that's the mistake that gets made. Innovation means that there's going to be a period where things are going to get worse. I mean, I often talk about Dick Fosbury as a great innovator in high jump. Reinvented the style of jumping over the bar, but he didn't break the world record in his first attempt at the Fosbury flop. It took him 10,000 attempts before he worked out that this is a better way of doing things.
Ergonomically, it still doesn't make sense.
It's still absolutely. You can imagine what his coach is going to say to him. You're going to run to the bar and you're going to turn around and go jump over backwards.
It is a bit odd.
Wake up in the morning or sit on board and whatever and say, we need another way, Daryl, we need to move to this, and we want to assume no risk and guarantee a success. You might as well wish to be taller, thinner, richer, and all that, and do nothing to get there, which is just dumb. It's just dumb. The Rubicon part of that is because in today's world, if you stand still, by definition, you are falling behind.
Yeah.
The world's not waiting for Nissan and to do what Toyota will do or vice versa. It's just not that. That's not the way it works. If you stand still, you will fall behind. You hire the best talent there is. As close as you can get to developmental brains, you hire Daryl and say, look, man, this is what we do really well. What else? What else is there? Mm-hmm. And, one of the things that you excel at is something I'd love to talk about is, I will phrase it in my own words, competencies that align, if you will. And the competencies are reality, resource, and willingness driven, leadership driven, and they align. You know, again, back to GM. Hey, we don't know anything about running laundry chain, so we sold it. And we don't know anything about milling grain, so as good a business as that is, it just drained intellect for the core business, the mother company, mothership. But then there are, you know, you and I talked about this before, the phenomenal thing is where one of the biggest law firms anywhere, I happen to meet a managing partner at some ridiculous function, but they have, they're an insurance defense firm. They are the best. If there's a big enough case, they are in the case. I mean, the clients live and breathe with these people. And the man asked me, how do we grow the business? I don't know how to market a law firm. But, you know, marketing, you know, think about it. And they have, I don't know how many lawyers, many across the country. And I promise you, if you're an insurance company with a big issue, you hire them. Everybody does. Hmm. So the question is, how do we grow the business? Wait, this is what we do. We pretty much got the market captured. What do we do? So I was thinking about Roger Smith. I said, you obviously invest the funds and all that. And I said, by the way, is there such a thing as a case that you handle where it that does not have significant tax components, financial instruments involved, actuarial stuff? Not elegant, but when it comes to actuarial things, say actuarial stuff. Because if you want to put people to sleep in a conversation, start talking about actuarial data. And I said, so you do all of that. Yeah, absolutely. And you have a division, which you call finance. It's a bunch of accountants. How do I know that? Because one of my friends is a consultant to you guys. He's a forensic accountant. Oh, well, will you come to us? Talk to us? And it doesn't take a whole lot of brain power to say, while you are solving that big problem for your client, how about you say your client, since we're going to consult on the forensic accounting side, can we do the forensic accounting work for you, starting with this and anything else? Well, you already have cachet, you're proven your value, otherwise you wouldn't be there. And then you go present, you bring in Bob, Mary, Joe, Dave, Daryl. This is the team. And they are all uber qualified because they deal in multi-million dollar lawsuits all day long. By the way, something you and I talked about. That was about as easy as sell through. They said, really, is that doable? I said, are you kidding? It's like you go to your favorite little market. The Japanese dude has the best fruit in LA. Little market. You go in there, and wow, it's wow. And you buy some apples. And the guy said, thank you, buying apples, great, beautiful, beautiful apples. Price ridiculous. And then he said, would you like some peaches? And he said, no. I'm going to go to Gelson's Market and buy the peaches there. These are the best peaches in town, and they're priced at 79 cents, $3 a pound. Gelson's is $5. No. I buy my apples here, buy my peaches there. Why? You like driving there? You like the whole parking lot thing? You like to overpay and buy that? My Japanese dude said, which I reject. I won't carry that in my store. And people walk out. Now, we talked about how to make them buy a peach, which is really funny. And that's kind of the same thing I worked through with this massive law firm, which, by the way, it took mind-numbing days and hours. Mind-numbing. You know, it's like it's the most difficult thing I have found in advisory work. It's a whole... Actually, we were going to do a whole thing about it at the Marshall School at USC, but they chickened out. The chancellor got fired. But it's like the old story. Oh, by the way, the Japanese guy, I said, this is what I would do. Went back 2 weeks later and said, I am selling so many peaches. Now I got to sell pears. Okay. It's kind of simple, actually. I said, next time somebody comes in, you used to recognize them to buy more apples, buy our peaches. No. Here's 2 peaches. Please take them home to your wife. Try it. Well, that's giving away free. We give away 2 peaches for free. We'll sell 700 rest of the year. It's one of the most amazing things to me, difficult things. Again, I proposed this as part of a relationship at the school. You know, the old story, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So the point is, the horse innately can smell water. I didn't know that until Elon Musk told me. And so a horse can smell water. The horse knows it must drink or die. The trough is over there. Horse can see it, smell the water. You take the horse to the trough and say, horse, water, and the horse won't drink. At the risk of dying of thirst. That is, I think, the most complex problem in doing consulting work. Now, you know, you have 2 options, drink or starve.
100%.
And I spend more time driving down to Orange County, a big building, sitting in a big conference room where people are saying things like, you know, that makes a lot of sense, but you think it's possible. Yeah. Okay, now, again and again and again. And that's when at some point I look at somebody and say, 2 questions. How about we try it? Take a medium-sized client and we'll go pitch. And when they say no or they're going to think about it, I tell my example to poor CEO that I walked to, I don't know, 1,200 retail stores over a few days in New York. I walked his ass off and those beautiful alligator shoes look like nothing. But we called on 1,200 retail stores to pitch an idea, and we sold 800 of them. Okay, now we know how to do that. But then again, that's when I stepped in this big room. I'm going to, who's going to get fired if you don't do this? Well, you know, that changed the paradigm, Daryl. Because the managing partner said, well, wait a minute now. I said, well, in by the world, why don't we go do that? Let's organize a nice lunch and go meet this massive insurance company. Okay, you know the thing we're handling for you. Can we do the rest to it while we're at it? By the way,
it makes so much sense. It makes so much sense. But you've got to get the pitch right, haven't you?
The newborn, every joke is new.
Of course, but you've got to get that pitch right. But Daryl, in terms of making big mistakes with AI-driven experimentation, right? How can leaders balance the speed of the AI-driven experimentation with the discipline that it's needed for systematic innovation? It's a big question, I know.
It's a classic contradiction question, right?
Totally.
So it gets to the heart of who we are as a business. I mean, I'll come back to Steve's beautiful example from a second ago. I think an awful lot of dealing with that contradiction is about appetite for risk. And what that actually means is emotional intelligence and, you know, just recognizing who's got skin in the game and how do they see the world. And if they're the horse in the metaphor, I can lead them to water. That's the easy part. I can't make them drink. But the emotional intelligence part is encourage them to recognize that when they are at the water, they are going to drink. So I think almost inevitably that means let's try something. In an innovation setting, fundamentally, there is no data. You know, you've got historical data that might have got you to the point where you're at. But in terms of this idea, is this going to work? There is no data. Yeah. So the only thing you can do is get out there and try something. And at that point, I usually come back to that we've got the One Percenters book coming out, and you know, it talks about business leaders that have been successful, military leaders that have been successful, and von Clausewitz on war, critical mass at the critical point. So when Napoleon was successful, then he understood what resources I got, what's the goal I've got, and are the resources consistent with achieving that goal? And if they're not, then I need to find a smaller goal. Yeah, and if I want to devote even less resources, I need to find an even smaller goal. So what that usually comes down to is, what's the smallest experiment we can do that spends you the least amount of money, that's going to get you some of that data you need to justify to your board and to everybody else that, yeah, this is worth spending some more money on. Yeah, and I think, yeah, that's I always describe it as, I'm here to get you some tangible benefit as quickly as possible. Yeah, and that usually means, yeah, we're going to try and spend the least amount of money to make you the most progress. So you've got the data that you need, and you're then confident that, yeah, I should spend some more money on this. But I think one of the things I've seen, particularly in big companies, usually in the US, is that there'll be an immediate chunk of enormous chunk of money thrown at a problem. And it's almost invariably a bad idea. Yeah, it just forces the team to go with the old tropes. I think a classic innovation thing is, you know, give the innovation team slightly not enough time and slightly not enough money, because it forces the creativity. I think I may have told you in previous conversations, you know, when I was a chief engineer at Rolls-Royce, typically it takes about 100 people to design an engine. Whenever I had the opportunity, I would say to four or five of the team, okay, you're red team. They're blue team. They're going to do what we usually do, design the engine. You're going to design the same engine. Here's the same specification. Clearly you've not got enough resources because you're missing 95 people. But you know what I always did with those five people, and you know, the reason they were there was because they couldn't use the same rules as today, they had to find better ways of doing things. Yeah, so almost invariably, there was some piece of magic that came out of those five that then was able to transfer to blue team and say, oh, look what these guys have found. Yeah, let's introduce that into your design now, and we can save ourselves a whole bunch of time and money. Yeah, but mm-hmm. it's that starvation. You know, here's a team. Yeah, I mean, I handpicked those teams because I knew how much comfort they had with discomfort. And they, you know, they were the people that, you know, I think a lot of people in times of discomfort, they just become paralyzed. These are the sort of people, the one percenters, that thrive on the discomfort. Yeah, thrive on the mm-hmm. fact that they don't have enough resources and see it as a spur to come up with breakthrough ideas. Yeah, we know this won't work, so we're going to have to do something different.
You know, Daryl, it's fascinating to see the one percenters act. Fascinating to see them deliver when they are absolutely faced with just awful, faced with no solution, faced with imminent collapse, danger everywhere. Mm. And their eyes get that big, they get highly energized. And that's the leader that you want to follow if you want to be a leader yourself. Yeah. The 1%, when I talk about that, I'm looking forward to the book. I've had my share of experiences with companies that were good, bad, and different, exceptional, terrible, who just did not have that 1%er, 1%ers, right, who survived or thrived by virtue of a product that was unique enough, by an established presence, maturity, and so on. Mm. And then, as you point out, it's an amazing thing where companies that begin with an entrepreneur and they hand it down and so on, where the heart and soul passes away, and now you have a whole bunch of technologists, if you will. I'm not saying that pejoratively, but technologists who now are going to try to recreate that. One day, I'd love to tell you about a client who ran a massive company in manufacturing a certain clothing line, and my job was to figure out what the hell to do with him. There was all these educated, incredible people running around the world, and manufacturing, doing all that, and the manufacturing factories. And my guy discovered saving whales and air pollution. And he spent his day in a corner of our office in a big chair in robes, listening to Ravi Shankar playing sitar music. And the parking lot had not been cleared or mowed in 10 years because he doesn't like the gas thing. And he does have a 20-year-old pickup truck. What do you do with him? Because he was the heart and soul of the business. What do you do with him and not kill the business? The business is going to die because his attention. And, you know, the worst part of his day is when he figured out that the whales were saved I had to find something else to say. Those things happen. You know, it's a funny thing. Von Kaushevitz, I mean, wrote the book, wonderfully quotable. And I ask, and I don't know this, naively ask, did he ever win a war? I think that we hired Daryl Mann to win the damn war.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a great point, because I mean I got a slide with a 2x2 matrix on it that I use all the time, and it's got, you know, one dimension is the academic, the person who steps back and studies stuff, and there's the doer, the practitioner, the entrepreneur, and that's the person that goes out and does it. And people tend to be one or other of those things. They, you know, they're the academic or the practitioner. So Napoleon was a practitioner. Von Clausewitz was a theoretician. Who studied things. The people you should listen to, certainly when it comes to innovation, are the people in the top right-hand corner of the matrix, the people that are both practitioner and the person who's been able to stand back and study stuff. And that's a pretty rare group these
you
days.
Know,
because
it's kind of interesting. A couple of days ago here, the new War Department, interesting descriptive, but it is. You know, you read that news. They called together the top 800 flag officers. He said, generals, one star above, admirals, one stripe and above. This is it. As far as August audience goes, these dudes and women are it. Mm. And they're being lectured on how to be war fighters and how to lose weight, which was really, it was precious. It was priceless. What Pete Heck said tells him that he doesn't want to see any overweight generals walking down the hall. This is phenomenal. And then, speaking of theoreticians and so on, now, a lot of all those people went through, most of those people went through one of the academies, which is a 75 academic, 25% military sort of thing. And I looked at this picture of this phenomenal man. Everybody looked like they had a salad bar on their chest. It was amazing, all the colorful stuff. And I said, now, the absolute edge. This is absolute. The armed forces, I'll pick on the arm, are run by the non-commissioned officers. It's the master sergeants that run the darn army.
Yeah.
And if the master sergeant says, general, no, general says, yes, sir, master sergeant, we'll do what you want. So without them, it doesn't run. Now, the one percenters in the armed forces are the couple higher levels of non-commissioned officers. Try running a $40 billion nuclear sub without a master chief on board. Not going to happen. I think we'll say.
Yeah.
All the officers, you can just you know, get the master sergeant the key and just go away. They'll do it. So it's a kind of funny thing. I thought about that in context of our chat. I said, who are the 1%ers in that room? They're not there. They're non-commissioned officers.
I've got a question for both of you. You first, Daryl. How do we future-proof leadership? Is there some kind of blueprint for future-proofing leadership moving forwards into like 2020, moving towards 2027? Because we can't really look that far forwards, in my opinion.
No. I'm pretty convinced that we can't. So obviously I'm biased because we've just finished the 1%ers book, and you know, one of the things to pretty much at the end of the book is that the 1%er is almost never the CEO, because they are that practice, you know, that doer person, and the CEO mm-hmm. tends to be the person who's got their eyes on the world and making decisions about things. But I'm pretty certain that we're heading to a world where the 1%er is increasingly going to be the CEO. So that's not going to help desperately if we're thinking about current CEOs. Let me say a second thing, which probably also isn't going to help, but I think it's really telling. There's a book that's just come out called Breakneck, which is written by a guy called Dan Wang, and comparing China and the US. And I think makes the beautiful point that number one, why is so much stuff getting done in China at the moment? I mean, if you look at infrastructure projects in China, it's just absolutely incredible. And just comparisons with the US in terms of train track from LA to San Francisco versus Shanghai to Beijing, for example. And it's just chalk and cheese, you're completely at the end of the spectrum. And the conclusion is that if you look at the people, the leadership in China, so the top of the Politburo, they're all engineers. And if you look at leaders in the West, but in the US in particular, those people that get right to the top, whether it's politics or business, they're lawyers and they're accountants. And the fundamental difference between those two things are engineers are builders and lawyers and accountants are preventers. Yeah, they're process people whose job is to stop stuff from happening. And as long as we've got leaders in that situation, that mindset, then you're not future-proof. Yeah, because we're in a phase in the world now where we need the builders. So I will say that the point of the book is not to say that engineers are better than accountants or economists. What it is saying is that you need the right leaders at the right time. And if the world is in a build mode, you need builders as leaders. Yeah, you do not need people who are going to stop stuff from happening.
I would like to relate a personal aspect to that. In the little company I grew up in, I was 21 when I started in this little bankrupt mail order business, and it matured at $1.2 billion. I was the youngest person in senior management. And at some point, you know, we went through all the right plateaus, you know, entrepreneurial, managerial, the regressions, back to professional, entrepreneurial, all the whiplash stuff, because the owners, two men who started in a station wagon without a second gear, you know. So you grow. But at some point, I said this more often than not, we had the most bloated compensation package in our industry by multiples. And the department heads were accountants and engineers. You know, the guy ran operations, ran manufacturing, Goodyear rubber and tire, before we hired him to this little bitty company in the valley. Well, it was a little bitty, but we were hiding. You know, it's like you hire that guy and say, how can you possibly afford me? Oh, we'll double your salary. That's how. What do you guys sell? Cocaine? No, we're just privately held. We're quiet, loose lip sink ships. And in my little brain, which thankfully there are a couple people in my life that grounded my ass at 6 a.m. Sorry, I needed it. I would look at people and say, you are the most qualified. You run that for Max Factor, Heinz. I'm just an uneducated kid. So here's the drill. I will drive this truck so hard that you're going to get a nosebleed. Your job is to make sure the wheels don't fall off. And part of that is when you walk into the office and you know I'm around and say, you want to blow it up? Keep doing it. Okay, don't tell me how to do it differently. Now, in terms of enduring leadership and all of that, to very much to the example you gave, I've concluded a couple of years ago that the whole leadership paradigm has changed dramatically in just recent years. And we do talk about leadership endlessly. The time where you had exceptional leaders, the people with vision, they saw it, all that, and drive. And then all that gets handed over to managers to execute. I've got the EQ, you got the bring it home IQ. And then I know we meet up at company retreats. That it's gone. The efficient leader today, by definition, has to be a very accomplished manager. He needs to know, he or she needs to know how that vision is implemented, by who, when, what are the logistics of all that. Otherwise, you can't control the enterprise. And you cannot, there's no such thing as detaching yourself from the engine. Not no such thing. Oh, I'm a leader. I should put my foot on the gas and brakes. But no. You don't need to know how to build a combustion engine, internal combustion engine, but better damn well know how it works and when it needs to work.
Totally.
My final comment is on all this, is on all that, and we can move on, is that I think that it is very elegant for a leader to teach people or incent people, whatever way, intellectually, financially, on what to think. But the most elegant part of leadership is to teach people how to think.
Yeah, agree.
Add dimensions to the ordinary. And that's how you build new leaders. And that's how you make sure that the wheels don't fall off the truck that's flying at vertiginous speed. Because there are people that you're grooming as a leader. You're incentivizing them, teaching them to think along the lines that you might think is, hey, there's more to this. Look, there's no such event that there's no more to it than what appears to be. It's like the best billboard I ever created was when Volkswagen reintroduced the Beetle in the United States. All these people, what are we going to say about the silly pale blue Beetle? I said, well, this is everything it appears to be and a lot less. Okay, well, the hero billboards follow. What does that mean? Well, a lot less gas, a lot less money, and you all know what a darn Beetle is. Okay, they sold a lot of pale blue ugly Beetles, but, you know, I think that the most elegant part of leadership is to impart and teach people how to think. And then you're sitting there alone saying, why the hell is the company lagging behind me?
Well, that's a very profound thing to stop on, I think. Did you have something you wanted to add, Darren?
Well, I was just going to add, if I may, a quick quote again, because I agree with what you're saying, Steve, completely. Yeah. I think that leaders should be breeding the next
round.
I think that the one thing I would say is, in terms of teaching other people to think, so teaching the next generation of leaders how to think, the one enormous benefit that engineers have got, there are lots of deficits into EQ, et cetera, but one of the enormous powerful things they've got right now is they understand systems. So my advice to leaders that are accountants and lawyers and the people who are tasked with stopping stuff from being done, number one, it's time to let your builders build now. But number two, if you're going to learn any new skills yourself, the things you need to be passed on to other people are, you need to understand what systems are, because we live in a world of ecosystems.
You do know that the best law school students come out of engineering schools.
I do, yeah. I teach. Well, I haven't taught for a few years now, but I teach at one of the best engineering schools in the UK. And one of the reasons I said I probably don't want to be doing this anymore is that we had a year cohort, very good year it was, and I think it was something like 95% recruited into either consulting or accounting. Yeah, but they were not going to be engineers. Yeah. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you, Daryl. Thank you, Stephen. Really enjoyed it. And if you are still watching this, do subscribe to the channel if you're listening on a podcast show, and check out what we're doing at MondayInfluencer.com, because we've got lots more interesting, informative, educational content.
Great talking to you guys.